Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is brought to you by the Era Media Group, publishers of ShowSite Magazine. Together, we are strong supporters of the American Kennel Club and the preservation of our purebred dogs. Okay, crew, before we get into today's show, I am super excited to tell you about something new here at Pure Dog Talk. We know breeders are the lifeblood of our sport. We celebrate and honor our master breeders. So we're bringing you Breeders' Voice. Breeders' Voice sits down with top breeders, sharing their secrets, how they got where they are, the joys, and maybe even the heartbreaks. If you haven't had a chance, click the Don't Miss an Episode button so you'll get these in-depth articles delivered free along with your podcast. Sign up on our Facebook page or at puredogtalk.com. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and Sue Huebner of Cordmaker Pulik. I am incredibly honored to have you join us. Your dogs are certainly world-renowned and very, very successful, and I am very much looking forward to you having the opportunity to share some of your good advice with our listeners. So welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. So what's your background? Your background as a breeder? What got you started in Pulik? Some of your mentors? Any of that kind of information would be amazing.
Okay. We started in Pulik by default. We were looking for a family dog, which I think is probably not an uncommon beginning for people who end up in the show ring and breeding dogs. My husband is German and never owned a dog. So there was a great deal of pressure on my part to own a dog. And when we moved into our family property, which had acreage, it seemed to suggest that this was the time. And because he was unfamiliar with dogs, of course, it involved me doing a great deal of research and a lot of persuasion to try and say this was the best dog that we should have. So we visited many, many, many kennels and looked at many, many, many breeds, right? Large, small, fat, long, thin. And eventually I said to him, you need to be fair. Please tell me what type of dog you want. So we sat down one day and we did a list of criteria. Now, that sounds like we really well researched our first dog. And we thought we had. So I went through then, at that stage there was no internet. So I went through one of those, encyclopedias of dogs with my list, okay, eliminating breed by breed, and eventually came up with the Poodle. Anyway, so I was very excited. I think my husband was equally excited because at the bottom it said rare breed. So I think he thought to himself, the chances are we won't end up with a rare breed. As luck would have it, an advertisement appeared in the paper for a litter of Pulik, which was unusual in this country because there were so few breeders.
Sue, what year was this?
1978.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
So we went and we had a look at this litter, and of course, you fell in love and this puppy you could have, and we brought the puppy home, and my family had had miniature poodles, not bred them, but always owned them, and I'd always done obedience. So my first move was into obedience, and I always believed that that was a lucky thing for me, because I think obedience teaches you a great deal about temperament in dogs and affinity with dogs, and I've never really regretted that that was my beginning. So we took our young Koshut, he was called, along to his obedience class, and someone came up to me and said, you have a Poolie. So I was somewhat amazed, thinking I had the only rare breed that no one would recognize, right, in Australia. I said, yes, I do. He then pointed to the ground and said, this is a Poolie. I said, no, that can't be a Poolie. My Poolie's not going to look anything like that. He said, yes, I assure you, this is a champion Poolie. I said, oh. What I hadn't realized was that the pictures that I had in my encyclopedia of dogs was a nine-month-old Poolie.
Oh, no.
When we had gone to the breeder, of course, the coat had been clipped off. The sire wasn't there. So I came home very humble to my husband and said, the point on this list, which said easy care, I think we failed. So we continued with obedience with Koshut, and this same person at obedience was actually the person that got me into dog showing. He came to me one day and said, I won't be coming, he was doing obedience trialing, which we all were, and the dog was very successful. And he said, I won't be coming to training on Sunday, I'm going to a dog show. I said, what is a dog show? Oh, it's such and such. He said, but your dog wouldn't be good enough. Now, if anyone who now knows me long term would know, first of all, don't insult my family, okay? And secondly, out came the competitive edge, right? So I thought, okay, I'm going to these dog shows. Please understand, he certainly was not a star show dog. But he was the right temperament. He was a really good little learning dog for me. And he got his title. And at that stage, I was very proud of that. That was all I aspired to. And then it just began to accelerate from there. We then bought two more, Pulik. We went to get one. And my friend, who was a mentor of mine as well, said, I can't distinguish between these two. Why don't you take both? So we'd now gone from a researched list, right, for one dog to the very casual purchase of two. So I came home and the idea was to run one on, a concept I didn't understand because we became so emotionally connected that run on, right, was obviously an ineffectual excuse for having these two dogs. So we ended up with the two of them, and one went as an obedience dog, right, eventually, and the other stayed with us. And I guess the thing about Pulik is that you need to really understand their temperament. And it doesn't matter how many times someone will tell you, you need to, you know, socialize these dogs, they're one-man dog by instinct and so on. When you're very new to a breed, you don't really take that seriously. So this dog had really what I would describe as a poor temperament. He was wonderful with us, but he had absolutely no interest in anyone else, including the judges in the show ring. I always thanked this boy. His name was Rumpole, right? And at this stage, there was a television show on with a very cantankerous lawyer called Rumpole, and that's why he was named Rumpole. So I always say, people say to me, you never bred from Rumpole. I said, no, but he taught me more than any other poodle I'd ever owned. And because he was difficult, I then had to learn. And then I think that is why temperament became so paramount with me, with my breeding program, with my placement of dogs in pet homes. It really is the thing that we talk about the most in the breed, because I know what can happen if you're not very, very aware of it. And as much as people will say there's a debate between is temperament bred or is it basically a product of the environment, I think it's both. So I think as a breeder, you need to keep certain key things in your mind. And it may not be the most beautiful dog you have, but if you have a very clear goal, temperament must always come first. Then as time goes on, I believe, you are now genetically breeding temperament. It's a bit like saying, you know, heads are all that matter. Yes, you'll produce good heads. So I think sometimes you need focus. I don't think focusing on heads is all that helpful, but I think focusing on temperament is very helpful and very helpful in this breed.
Well, and particularly because not every dog that you produce is going to a show home. They have to be able to live in companion homes.
Yes, exactly. And I think new breeders need to understand that those family homes are part of their breeding program, not because they're going to necessarily breed those animals. You know, someone will say, oh, I've put them in there, but I can have a litter. I say, no, you need the companion homes. If you produce five puppies in a litter and only one of them suits the goal that you've set at the time, four others are there. So the criteria that I've always used and the criteria that my two partners who are taking over the kennel use is we have to have the family homes first.
Absolutely.
So if we don't have the family homes, we then can't breed the dogs.
All right. I love that. And I do love the conversation. I have some interviews that I'm hoping to get a hold of in the near future, talking to actual scientists, talking about the genetic basis of temperament, because it's something I agree with you. I personally believe that it's both. You can't start with bad and get to good.
And I think there's also a great social pressure now that there isn't a tolerance for, I don't wish to malign a breed, but there really isn't a great level of tolerance unless the temperament is consistent with the golden retriever. And I think that's particularly sad. We had Lois Wolf White come and judge here many, many years ago. And we had a small social gathering afterwards because we were so excited to have an overseas judge. And she started by saying, you have a major fault in the breed. And of course, everybody gulped. And she said, your dogs are far too friendly. Now, the point I make basically is, yes, it says sensibly suspicious of strangers, right, is in the breed standard. But unfortunately, it's not in the social consciousness. They want the dog to be outgoing, gregarious, able to play with the neighbor's children.
Well, I think one thing, and I come from a similar temperament breed, it's that sensibly suspicious. I think sensibly is the part that many of us lose track of.
Exactly. Exactly.
You get suspicious and then it bites you, or you get golden retriever, and you can't get that just stand up, sort of aloof, self-contained dog.
I think that's absolutely right.
You're dead on. And I was just wanting to kind of highlight that for people to think about, because a golden retriever has one temperament. A Pooley has another temperament. A wire haired pointer has another one. And a Staffordshire Bull Terrier has another one. And they shouldn't be the same if, as preservation breeders, we are achieving the goal of preserving that breed. Yeah.
I suppose the difficulty is too that when you start to look at the preservation, what would you call it, focus, which we know all now desperately need to have in order for any of our breeds to survive long term. I think when you start to look at that preservation focus, one becomes as a breeder very torn between the adage of form follows function, and that we should therefore be going back and researching, right, the traditional functions of these breeds, that we feel we have a commitment, which I always feel I do, that if my dogs had the chance to work in that environment, the same as in Hungary, in those conditions, with that stock that they had to herd, that they could still do it. And part of that was temperament. In fact, it was a large part of it. So it becomes a conflict between, does preservation include temperament when temperament seriously impacted on the actual purpose of the breed, or do we now have to say, well, we are now in such a situation with preservation that we have to take account of the fact that in most cases our dogs go into a companion home. That's where they go. So it's a real tension. Do you know what I mean? I watch my dogs and I think, I love the fact that you're sensibly suspicious, that you stand back, that you don't want to gregariously approach a stranger and so on. And then I think, yes, but in the hands of the family with their three little children walking in the park, they say, oh, I'll go and talk to them. And you say, but it doesn't work that way. So it's a real tension, because I do think preservation is temperament as well.
I think you make a really, really beautiful and very eloquently stated point, Sue, which is that it is difficult to reconcile these. So then suggestions from you as to how do we as breeders attempting to preserve historically correct temperaments that may or may not fit well into today's society. What are your suggestions in terms of, okay, do we educate our homes? How do you work with that?
I can only tell you my own approach, because I don't have sufficient scope to really be able to generalize with other breeds. I'm sure that the strategy is different, but I do think the first step is that you need an awareness of it. You need to understand it. You need to have had some experience with it. Like my difficult dog, Rumpole, taught me very, very quickly what could happen. So I think the first thing is that you have that as one of your objectives. The second thing is that you have a strategy in place, particularly with companion dogs that are going into family homes. And when we are looking at it now, is we, because there are three of us now working because I plan to retire fairly soon. When we look at family homes, the amount of time that we spend educating them before they get the dog. In other words, this is what to expect. This is how you need to behave. Now, some of them take us very, very seriously, so the transition is absolutely wonderful. Others will ring and have problems, and we've done this, we've done that, and we immediately respond, and we tell them, you may have bought your Pooley because you think he has a glorious coat, but you've actually bought his temperament because that's what you're going to be living with. Now, we've probably had one instance where we had to bring a dog back from a family, but the consequence of that is the amount of time that you spend with your companion families. And, you know, we had a litter not long ago of 13 Pulik. Everyone went, oh, how amazing.
Oh, my God. That's a lot of Pulik.
All we could think of was, well, if we only keep two of those, this is 11 companion homes, all of which will need lifelong involvement. And that's how we see it. So, in a way, I suppose I can't emphasize enough that your companion homes are part of your breeding program. They are. They're your advertisement. They're the family that comes back for the second Pooley because they were so happy with the first. And I don't think that I could have had a breeding program at all if I didn't have wonderful companion homes. Well-researched, but still wonderful companion homes.
Absolutely. That is wonderful, Sue. And thank you very much for focusing on that. So you are talking now, and I think, again, another exceedingly important point for new folks coming into breeding dogs or coming into wanting to purchase a dog to exhibit, etc. The idea that every puppy in your litter is not perfect and you are doing a particular breeding to accomplish a particular thing and you are then selecting those puppies because they meet that goal you wanted to achieve with that litter. Yes?
I think the process of breeding and the process, obviously, inherently of selection. I remember when I came, bred my first litter, and people would say to me, oh, well, you know, you need to choose the best one, and that's the one that you keep, and so on. The problem with your first litter is that often you don't have enough skill. So it tends to become a mixture of a limited amount of skill and a lot of emotion, because one has become attached to a particular puppy. But I tend rather to say, I'm not looking for perfection anywhere. I'm looking for, initially, good, sound animals that, as a result now of effective health testing and so on, I can hope and trust will be healthy and long-lived. And I think because of that, my assessment processes have always been a little more general. Like, I can remember when the two girls came in with the kennel and we were assessing a litter not very long ago. In fact, the litter that Mr. Blue Sky that's in America came from. And we all gathered together in the backyard and they said, Sue, do you want a table? I said, no. They said, you don't want a table? I said, no. I said, I can manipulate these puppies into any shape I like. I said, I want you to sit and I want you to watch. And I said, what you have to do is what we tell judges they have to do. You have to develop an eye so that when you're looking at those puppies and your eye keeps going to a puppy, you go, you know, every time there's five of these and Blue Collar is the one that's coming at me every single time. And it may be through temperament, it may be through structure. And then you actually look at those dogs and unpack it and look at angulation for what it's worth in a young pup. You know, it's like they're so poorly muscled, so things can happen to the forequarter. It's not held on by anything but muscle. They have very little musculature in their hindquarters. So, you know, trying to put them on a lead and trotting around the yard. I suppose it's just a different approach, and I'm certainly not condemning people who take that more analytical approach, but it has never been easy for me to do that. It's always been, let's look at them all. And all of them, as I said, and I think breeders have to think this, all of those puppies are perfect for something. It is only the purpose that makes them imperfect. So our purpose is to breed a dog from a particular breeding that has the genetics that we want to produce a beautiful dog that will enhance and further our breeding of the Poolick. That's what we're looking for, or is what we should be looking for. But in actual fact, every one of those little puppies is perfect for something. So it's a very generalized approach, I know. I always feel as though I'm not sufficiently analytical when I discuss this.
No, I love it, actually. I think a lot the same way, so it's ringing very true to me. But I think you make really valid points as regards finding the right home for each puppy. You know, you go through a litter and everybody says, oh, I want the pick puppy. I'm like, what I pick and what you pick are not necessarily the same dog.
Exactly.
So I think that your comment about each one is perfect for something is so beautifully said. I was sort of awestruck at the eloquence. So talking about Mr. Blue Sky, very successful here in the United States, and certainly not the first Cordmaker Poolick to be successful here. I mean, this is long-running, 20 years worth of top-ranked, very, very successful Cordmaker dogs all around the country. So talking about a breeding program and developing a breeding program that creates, if you will, a family of dogs. So you can pick out a Cordmaker dog every time because fill in the blank.
I think the first thing is to start to develop an eye. I think a lot of people begin a breeding program by doing a lot of research on breeding, and then when it comes to the actual selection, they don't have the skill. And I think the selection is based on what are the characteristics that you value in that breeding program, and I think that it's obviously based on the breed standard, but I think the other side of it is that you need to research and understand, and I mean intimately understand the breed. And that is not a simplistic understanding of a breed standard. When I began in 78 to gain knowledge about the breed was a very challenging thing. Now I go Google search. And as I say to my people when I give lectures, I believe now there is no excuse for ignorance. None. In other words, accessing information is easy. Accessing old pictures is easy. Accessing videos of, in that case of Poolick, herding in their traditional way is easy. So to me, the first thing is to say, yes, I understand, right, that I am breeding to a breed standard. I think you need to understand that, and I think I'm still growing in understanding 40 years later. something will come to me that will say, ah, now I know why that was there or why that needed to be expanded. I guess my positive is that I actually love the research. So some people would say, well, I really don't want to take that approach, right? Far too academic. I actually love that approach. So what I did was I basically looked at dogs that I loved. I did a lot of research. I came up with one particular kennel in Australia when I began, and one in the United States, and one in the UK. And as well as saying this is where I wanted to go, right, with my program, these were where I liked the dogs, I was privileged and lucky enough to be able to visit. So I went and visited these kennels. One of the most influential kennels for me, right, in the US, and the most influential kennel behind Cordmaker is Wallbanger, belonging to Anne Bowley. Now, Anne Bowley and I had not said very many words at all when I decided that I loved her dogs. I went to visit at a specialty, and what I actually loved about her dogs was the breeding program, because when I looked at how had she produced these consistently beautiful dogs, and I looked at the pedigrees and I looked at the dogs I liked, and I said, you know, I want a pedigree that looks like this from my first outcross. So it began with paper, really. So the dogs that I admired were no longer alive, but the ones that she had still had that stamp. So in a way, it was Anne Bowley's dogs that created in me the visual of that's where I want to go.
Very nice.
I think the danger is it's not about the winning dog. People will talk to me and they'll say, you've been so successful, as you've just done, and it's certainly I'm proud of it, right? But it's not the way the breeding program works. It's not about how many champions and haven't you done well and, you know, you have an international reputation. Yes, I love that. We all love the praise for 40 years worth of hard work. But in the end, the champion part doesn't matter. The number one all breeds doesn't matter. It's the capacity of having dogs that can carry the gene pool through and continue to produce the type that you have in your mind's eye that's come from research, understanding the breed, understanding the purpose and history of the breed, and having an opportunity to look at dogs and say, put them up in a row and say, this is what I like. Yes, the dog show will help you test if you've made the correct decision, but it's only part of it. It's not a particularly exact test of the quality of your breeding stock.
No, it's not.
So you can't rely on it. And newcomers who come into breeding programs, they rely on it because they rely on the outcome of the results of the dog show. I will only breed to a champion. This one has won 15 times. The problem of the dominant sire, and so on. Many people, when they begin breeding, that's the only information they have. And it is one of my views, right, many rare breeds, right, seriously under threat. We have a Dandy Dinmont, right, as a pet, who's taught me a great deal about what it means for a breed to be under threat. But many breeds are under threat. The most recent information that's come out, it can be anything up to 70%. And it's got nothing to do only with how many of them there are. We have all these breeds under threat. So that then changes what you do. If you think that you want to be called a preservation breeder, you have to earn the title. And the title will be about how you breed. And I can give you a very, very simple example. I can always remember that part of my interview, every interview I've ever had, I would very proudly say that over the course of 40 years, I have only bred 20 litters. And they go, oh, wow, that would always get into print. But since now I look at the current situation, I think, how much did I actually contribute to the preservation of the poodle? And when I would condemn other breeders who had 3 litters a year, which we're very prone to say now they are a puppy farmer, in our current circumstances, we need to breed.
Yeah, we've talked about that on the show, so absolutely agree with you on that.
All right, guys, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much, Sue, for your invaluable input on creating a family of dogs, on puppy selection, on developing an eye, and the importance of companion homes that we all need. And listeners, I know that you are going to be very excited to stick with us and stay tuned next Monday when we continue this conversation with Sue on building pedigrees, breeding philosophies that produce winners, but also stand the test of time in preserving a breed. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk, brought to you by the Era Media Group, publisher of ShowSite Magazine, your home for purebred dogs.